In 1967, we awoke to the knowledge of the village. Now, 50 years on, we invite you, good citizens, to join us in celebrating the timeless topics, eloquent prose, and striking visuals of the iconic programme, The Prisoner.
Good day, and greetings, dear villagers. It's a beautiful day in the village, despite the chance of light rain and the presence of a dilemma. Good people, the Eternal Village cast is exceedingly proud to share a conversation with the talented actor, director, and insightful writer, Mr. Rupert Booth.
Rupert, when you were, let's go to those pivotal early teen years, those years when you become sort of aware of your world around you and the things that enthrall you.
Sure.
We all start to get asked by grandparents and teachers, everyone around us, what do you want to be when you're a grown-up? Mm-hmm. And as children, maybe in your and my generation, the answers would be very strategic. They'd be lawyer, they'd be plumber, they'd be doctor. When did you come to the realization that your desire was to be creative, to be someone who saw nothing but created something? Was that early in life, later in life, after some psychotherapy? How did it happen?
That was very early in life. That came before my teens even, I think. Trying to remember back to the late Cretaceous when I was young. I was always telling stories to myself, to anyone who'd listen. Mm-hmm. And if that was acting out stories with a combination of Star Wars figures and Lego and plasticine and cardboard and anything I could get to make sets, if you like, and make props for my little action figures. And then later on for myself, you know, and mates, you start kind of gathering your gang together. And I started finding like-minded individuals who just enjoyed the act of creating. Honestly, there wasn't really ever any other path. There's nothing else I'm good at for a start.
I doubt that, yeah, but go ahead.
Somewhat limited in choices. But you know, it's the idea of working in a bank or something like that just crippled me, the thought of it. You know, and that's nothing against people who do. I rather envy them. I seriously mm-hmm. do. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a sane life choice to become a creative, but it wasn't really a choice.
Well, and I agree with that profoundly, and that's why I am so, quite frankly, inspired by people who do take that enormous risk, because in life, these jobs I'm about to list are essential. When you think about a society, the truth of the matter is whenever we have something bad that happens, if we don't have men and women who come along and pick up the refuse and the garbage, we create disease and problems. If we don't have someone who understands how to get water to us through pipes, we die. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, we have people who create the structures around banks and laws. And in all those cases, all those individuals have a set schedule, Monday through Friday, Tuesday through Sunday. Mm-hmm. They're given direction to be able to do something, a little bit of guidance, and they get a pay packet every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Where I find people like yourself that are actors and writers is my curiosity about your fortitude to be able to take, quite frankly, an onslaught of rejection or an onslaught of unsubstantiated criticism of the work you're trying to do, and yet you maintain the willingness and the focus to keep trying. Where does that come from, Rupert? Where is that well of reserve that you have?
Oh, it's just bloody-mindedness, really. like I say, there's nothing else, really. It would be either that or give it all up and get a day job, and like I say, that would be crippling.
Right.
You know, emotionally crippling, I suppose, in a way.
Yeah.
You get. You know, as far as we know, you have one life that we can guarantee. Mm-hmm. I really think that you should use it in whatever way you decide to, provided that you're not hurting other people along the way, or, you know, doing your best to not do that.
Yeah.
And I mean, to go back to what you were saying earlier about all those people, you know, who are, you know, people who build structures, whether they're physical or in terms of, you know, setting laws and things like that, to doctors, to astronauts and street sweepers and the lot, the one common denominator we all have is that we all have stories. We all have our things that motivated us as children or adults. We all, you know, have the TV programs we watch, the books we read, the media we consume, if you like. And that's something that's never changed. That's never changed from, you know, look at the earliest cave paintings. They're telling stories.
Yeah, agreed.
And I seem to have some facility for doing that. And it's always something that's come naturally to me. As much as any of this can be considered natural. Was that a comprehensive answer?
No, that is. So let's start leading down this path. There you are, you're a young adolescent, and you realize that you are someone who can weave a story, create a tale. Growing up in the British school system, did you have the chance in what I would call high school, I guess you call it upper school?
Was it
high school? Okay. Did you have the chance to participate in, for example, formal drama programs there? Did you get a chance to start to hone and mold those skills at an age? Or was this something that happened after you left school?
There wasn't all that much of that going on at my school. There were drama classes, but I didn't take them because I was trying to be sensible. The subjects that would get me ahead in life later. It's like you said earlier, you know, one wants to please one's parents and try and do the sensible thing, even though my heart wasn't ever in it.
Right.
So I didn't do that at school much, apart from in English. There was a fantastic English teacher called Mr. Vale, Kevin Vale, his name was. And he's that teacher who everyone talks about in their lives, who inspired. He really took an interest in my writing, you know, the essays you have to write at school. And we would, you know, act out Shakespeare plays. I mean, not just me and him, that would be crazy and probably weird. You know, the entire class obviously would be set Shakespeare texts to do and so on. I started reading Shakespeare and realizing kind of, blimey, I see why everyone goes on about Shakespeare still. I see why he has lasted for so long, because he's bloody good. And the lyricism of the language and all that sort of thing. And so, you know, some of the acting came out of that, but mostly the acting side of it. The acting side of it, rather than the writing, was all outside school.
When then, because unfortunately, in our world, at some point, we have to find a way to, and I hate this word, but commercialize whatever skill we have. When you became... and I hate this word, who knows if we ever get there, but a grown-up, where did you start to be able to manifest your art into a paying or commercialized endeavor? Did you start with writing for nonfiction, fiction? How did that path develop for you?
Not for a long time. I ended up doing something sensible instead for a while. But during that time, because this was the 90s and you could get hold of half decent editing kit, you know, SVHS I used and VHS to begin with. Had a camcorder, had a little edit suite, had lots of friends, and so just started making stuff, amateur stuff for fun. You know, with never any intention of really showing it to anyone, just all get together and have a laugh and make something. And that, I realized later, was the way of kind of honing my skills. You know, you do these things and learn by making mistakes.
Of course.
And looking back at it and going, right, I'll not do that again, hopefully. So it wasn't for a long time, really, that... I mean, my first professional commission for a piece of writing was, I think... did I do acting first? I can't remember. Doing a short story for Big Finish, maybe, and then The Prisoner's Dilemma was very shortly afterwards.
So in a time sense, in this millennium has been when you've had the chance to start to put these skills.
Taking it seriously anyway, yes.
Right. In the 90s, when you were balancing between having that daily commitment but being creative as well, were there chances for you to be able to start to exercise your thespian talents, like in local theater, community theater, other things? Were there chances when you can get up on the boards and start to use that muscle?
Yeah, I did actually go to a stage school at some early point. I think it might have been in it was after the Cretaceous, but the dinosaurs had died out by that point. And I didn't like it at all. I you see, the thing is, I don't like going up on stage. I'm very much of Patrick Troughton's viewpoint, the actor who was the second Doctor in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
He used to deride being on the stage, just all that bloody shouting in the evening. And I'm kind of like that. So I exercise my thespianism in these amateur things to begin with. Mm-hmm. You know, which I was, for me, it was a good way of doing it. I much prefer working with the camera than going on stage. I like feedback. I like the fact that you change the performance from, you know, if it's a long shot, you go a bit bigger than if it's an extreme close-up, things like that. You know, that interested me. Filmmaking and television and film were the two things that always really grabbed me. So that was what I kind of went towards.
I think an actor sees the performance both before, while, and after, and has seen versions of it. Is that something that happens to you, that you metamorphosize different ways of doing it before and after the take?
Interesting question. I mean, I what I try and do is hit exactly the same thing every single take for continuity reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, if I give two wildly different takes and they want to use bits of each, that's going to be quite difficult. So once I've done the first take, as long as it wasn't shite. Am I allowed to swear? Sorry.
You can swear all you want.
then I'll try and, you know, unless the director wants a different interpretation, then I'll try and keep to that. But I mean, to be honest, I like trying to get that sort of stuff nailed down in rehearsal so that when you get on set, it isn't even up for discussion anymore.
Makes sense.
You know, you don't always get rehearsals on film. You know, sometimes you do rehearse record where you get together and do the scene first a few times, run it through, and then camera starts rolling.
Yep.
Now,
as someone who had early on not only crafted the story but crafted the film, do you have a pull to be involved with multiple sides of things? Do you have a desire to be both behind and in front of the camera? Or what would be your preference?
Absolutely. Like I said earlier, I've always been fascinated by the entire process. I remember watching behind the scenes things on stuff like Star Wars in 1978, 79 maybe, when they're on telly, and reading the books about it and Doctor Who. It was always science fiction. Things like Blake 7, and being as fascinated by the behind-the-scenes story of how the thing is made as by the story that's being told on camera. Yeah, it's lovely sometimes to just come in and act on someone else's thing and for none of the rest of it to be your problem. That's great. I enjoy that enormously.
Yeah.
On my own stuff, absolutely. I mean, the thing I'm working on at the moment, I'm the lead writer on it, which I'm thoroughly sick of right at the moment, frankly. One of the actors in this as well, and I'll be involved in the design side. I'm working very closely with the director and the producer and you know, on everyone really on the team. I'll probably be involved in post-production. And yes, I enjoy that. It's also nice to be able to see things through to completion.
Yes, yes. And I would say the other thing is a consistency of vision. As to what
I agree. I think one of the reasons that things run into problems sometimes these days is when you have enormously budgeted productions that also have enormous numbers of producers, all of whom come and put an idea in, and you have to use that idea as a writer or a showrunner because they've got the money, but the idea ain't any good. Whereas you look at something like The Prisoner, which is one man's vision. And you know, how incredibly consistent is that with that vision? Hey, we're still talking about it.
Absolutely. And that I would say goes back to the idea of diligence and commitment. That was someone who was both diligent in a vision but committed to seeing it through.
Yes.
That's why, as we say, 52 years on, the slogan of our program is that it's eloquent prose and striking visuals and topics, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So let's go back a little bit. Curious about favorite things. You mentioned the idea of science fiction. You said things like Blake 7. When you were a young man and you were finding these things that enthralled you, What were some of the movies or television that were just your favorites before the era, maybe before the era when we could own things and watch it at our own pleasure? Were there certain things that when they came on the television, you were just ecstatic to hunker down and see?
Hell yeah. Anything, I suppose, the label telefantasy is the best thing. For example, Channel 4 showed the series The Avengers from the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In the early 80s. And I remember my dad saying, you're going to love this, watch this. And I sat down and it instantly became appointment television for me. I wouldn't miss an episode if I could possibly avoid it. Doctor Who was always like that. My maternal grandmother had watched Doctor Who since it started. And one of my very earliest memories is being curled up with her, being terrified by Pyramids of Mars. So I was literally indoctrinated there. Things like Blake 7. I mean, yeah, you could mention any science fiction or fantasy series from the 70s and 80s, and that was my thing. I was all over that.
Were you a Gerry Anderson fan?
Yes. Not in the way that fans are. I always enjoyed watching them.
Yeah.
But I related that. UFO, when I saw UFO, finally, I was more captivated by that than anything else he'd done. I think because I simply just respond better to people than the puppets.
Agreed. Right. Those that were the human-based shows.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
People always respond to people.
When looking, let's say we were to drop by your place and look at, if you have them, a collection of DVDs, would you say that in the realm of science fiction and fantasy that you are more drawn to those that are positive views of the future, or do you have a bent towards the dystopian stories, or do you like both? Where would you fall in that?
Both. It simply comes down to whether it's a good story, well told or not, with characters that appeal to me.
Right.
I'm a great fan of Star Trek. I always have been. I like to think that one day we'll get to something like Gene Roddenberry's vision of the future, mm-hmm. where everyone basically is nice to each other and doesn't act like a dick. Equally, I was always grabbed by Blade Runner when that came out, you know.
Right.
And especially living in the 80s, you know, the threat of instant nuclear annihilation for us all. Mm-hmm. I was drawn to a lot of narratives at the time that seemed to confirm my worst fears of we're all going to die tomorrow.
Did you ever, and I hope you have a chance to breathe and go to the sunlight after this, did you ever watch the amazing movie called Threads?
You know, funnily enough, I was going to mention Threads.
Yeah.
Then, yes. I didn't see it at the time. I think I was a little bit too young, and my parents thought, no, this will permanently damage him. And it would have done if I'd seen
it.
Fortunately, I saw it, I think. I can't remember if it was when it came out on DVD or whether a friend had a video that they taped off air and I got a pirate copy, basically. Mm-hmm. I remember sitting that and thinking afterwards, I'm glad I was in a good mood. If I'd been feeling down of a day, that wouldn't have been a great thing to watch. It is a magnificent piece of work.
In the cross-culturalism, when having conversations with friends about these themes, mm-hmm. if they've never seen these movies, I will always explain it this way. I will say that in the same year, it was 1984, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. that in the US, they created a movie called The Day After.
Day After, yep.
And in the UK, literally at the same time, you know, great minds think alike, you created Threads. The difference between these two movies is, I believe, the difference of mature realism. Because in A Day After, the movie ends with this, well, boys, we're going to get our tractors and our hammers and we're just going to rebuild, which is such an American mentality of, you can punch me in the eye, but I'm going to come back and make it okay. And the British one is like, well, we're screwed and we're screwed. And I didn't tell you enough times that we're screwed, because that movie ends at such a dismal point that the only thing you can do is walk away and say, why?
Well, I think the only thing you can do is walk away and say, okay, in nuclear war, there are not going to be any winners.
A warning may come quite unexpectedly. We will now tell you what to do if a warning sounds when you are at home. And then we will explain what to do if you are out of doors. First, if you are at home, if attack is imminent, you will hear the attack sound like this.
So peppered into that, either through television or through video, mm-hmm. when was in your life, when was the time that you discovered this crazy 17-episode show called The Prisoner? When did that come into play?
I'll tell you exactly when. It was 1989. And a friend of mine brought round, I'd never even heard of it, maybe references in a few magazines here and there, but you know, one couldn't just go on the internet and follow them up at that point.
Nope.
And he turned up with the Channel 5 tape that had Arrival and the Chimes of Big Ben on and said, look, watch this, seriously, you're going to love it, like my dad with the Avengers. Mm-hmm. And so I watched Arrival and instantly watched Chimes of Big Ben and then watched them again. And then I think went to the local library, which had copies of the first half of the series up to Many Happy Returns and Checkmate, I think was on one of those tapes, mm-hmm. and watched as much as I could. And was stunned by it, transfixed, mesmerized both by McGoohan himself and by the ideas, the ideology, I suppose, that it was putting forward. Very much fitted in with the one that I was forming. This was, it would have been 17, 18. And so sort of late teens and starting to go, okay, I know who I am. I know I'm forming opinions about politics and things like that and you know, how the world fits together or doesn't. And having always found at school, I always resented the whole thing of, you know, wear the uniform, do as you're told, mm-hmm. don't be too much of an individual because the world requires you to not be an individual. And I kind of thought, fuck that. And McGoohan very much was standing up there saying that in not so many words, in more eloquent words, in fact. So I was kind of looking for The Prisoner mm-hmm. without realizing mm-hmm. that I was looking for The Prisoner at that point, and it blew my mind wide open.
In that time span, 1989, there you are. Mm-hmm. It's on video. Did you have the ability or the wherewithal to be able to buy them and watch them again? Or was this something that you had to only get sporadically when you had time or could go to the library and lend them?
Wow. No. I had friends who, I think I had a friend who had some of the, who had all but Fallout in her local library. So mm-hmm. she went and got them out for me and I watched them. And then I went and bought Fallout. No, I tell a lie. I bought Fallout before I got to see the second half of the series because I thought, I have to know how this ends. Then it will all make sense to me.
Right. Nice theory.
And so I watched Fallout without having seen Once Upon a Time, apart from the little reprise at the beginning, of course, and then watched it again. And then my friend came around and I watched it a third time, sat him down and said, right, okay, you have to watch the last episode now. He'd been watching it with me. And we both sat there and went out and got some beer and had a sit and had a talk and went, okay. I loved it. I loved Fallout from the word go. I didn't comprehend it. When I finally caught up and saw Once Upon a Time in full, it did make more sense. The first time around, I didn't recognize who number one was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know? Oh, I didn't either. No, I remember. So listeners have heard me tell this story, but in the 1970s in the U.S., mm-hmm. The Prisoner was the very first commercially made show that was mm-hmm. sold en masse to America's public broadcasting channel.
Okay. Right.
So in 1977 or 78, here in Seattle, our mm-hmm. local channel had bought that packet.
Uh-huh.
And they showed it late on Friday nights. Mm-hmm. And I always say that at that point, I was looking for other things on TV besides a guy in a blazer and a white balloon. Mm-hmm. So I would click past it and uh-huh. had these vague representations sure. in my mind of something very colorful. But I was, let's be honest, I was probably looking for repeats of Benny Hill or anything more salacious than that.
Yes, quite.
But when I actually saw the series was in the year of 2000, exactly yeah. like you, yeah. I was at the library mm-hmm. and I saw the packet and I was like, wait a minute, vague memory, let's mm-hmm. try this. Mm-hmm. And very similar paths, you and I watched the first two mm-hmm. and was instantly part of this mindset. Mm. And I went and the very first box set of DVDs I ever bought in my life was that because I knew yeah. I want to possess it and want to see them all. And yeah. then that's just like you. It for me, it's created these conversations because I believe the show is that catalyst.
Oh, great.
The shows are brilliant. They are a time capsule, but I believe they open up doorways to having conversations about the themes that are still active.
Sorry, okay.
Yeah,
I think that's one of the triumphs of it. McGoohan said in, was it the 6-into-1 interviews? Yeah. Was saying he wanted, you know, one of the things he wanted to do is to get people standing up and talking and arguing and rile them into activity.
And he succeeded.
Yes.
Now, as a young person then in the, let's say, turning into the 90s, did you have the chance or the interest to find others of like mind? You mentioned 6-into-1 or other sci-fi associations in the UK.
Yeah.
Were you like a convention kid? Did you go to those type of things?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I did end up going to conventions later on, the mostly Doctor Who ones. Mm-hmm. In the early 90s, I joined 6-into-1, and their content in the early 90s was remarkable. You know, again, in a time before the internet. I wasn't so into seeking people out who were like-minded about it because all my friends had got into it as well.
Right.
So it wasn't, and you know, I was quite isolated up in Newcastle.
you're way in the corner. Okay.
I was way in the corner, yes. Maybe I should still be there. No. So it was a thing that was sort of, you know, with me and my gang and various people who I met who started coming on board the whole filmmaking and having fun side. I mean, I've been to a few prisoner conventions, but since, and usually after having written Prisoner's Dilemma.
As you then became more and more, if you will, aware or contextualized the things that fascinated you, mm-hmm. did the films that you were making with your mates, with your friends, did they represent that same thought process, mentality? Oh,
absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
To the point of unsubtlety. And The Prisoner was very, very, very much an influence on them as well, on my writing, on my creative thinking, always has been, I imagine, always will be. Yeah. And why the hell not? Yeah. They did represent that.
Do you still have those early productions? Have you transferred them on to other media to keep them safe? Are they part of your archive?
Yes, I have them all archived.
Good.
And no one's going to see them.
Well, that might be true. I'm always surprised when people say that they don't keep their art because I always think if you don't see what you've done, how can you visualize what you can make?
The things themselves are of very little intrinsic value, but it's kind of like a diary of my 20s, you know, those of my friends from the time. And of course, you know, I kept all the footage as well. So the behind the scenes stuff is really what I'd go to nowadays and look at and go, look at us all then, young and with hair and something.
Let's not pick that pain. That's too much. So in a recent conversation that I had with Matteo Latosa, Matteo is fascinating. And what's been great about these conversations is opening up people to realizing that they have a story to tell. Because Matteo was someone I pursued for a while. And he kept saying, but I have nothing to say. I have nothing to tell you. Until we started talking. And he is such a fascinating person.
Isn't he? Ferociously intelligent.
Totally is. Oh, absolutely. Creative. And he, in the story that is out behind the scenes right now, in the week that we're talking, is out, is he tells the entire story of how he was able to obtain the license to create what I call an expansion of this canon, to be able to add to the story of The Prisoner. Because if you love the show, great. Mm. There's 17 programs. Mm-hmm. But that, for a nurturing or growing fan base, is going to be too finite. So across these conversations, we've talked to people who've created music, created books, graphic novels. And then came Matteo, who said, based upon his experience with the Space 1999 books, we could turn these into a living legacy of stories. Mm-hmm. And he tells about having a dinner with Jonathan in Los Angeles. And the conversation he explains was that he said, well, I can do these, but who in the world would write them? And Jonathan looks across the table and says, me. I would.
Yep, absolutely.
Now where I want you to help me in this oral history is to understand this. Mm-hmm. How do you know Jonathan? What's your history with Jonathan? How did you decide to take on this challenge of writing, as I hold in my hand, this massive, beautiful, dense, complex story. Tell me about the genesis of that, please.
Right, so I first knew John because I had sent out some of the videos I mentioned before to people who were interested, and one of them had got to John and Kate, and they got in touch with me one day, early email, via a girlfriend's email account at university, I think. and so we'd been talking for a while, and I was actually at the convention in the States with him. I wasn't at the meeting with Matteo. And so I can complete your story of what happened at that meeting.
Please, I love the backstory.
That John comes up to me, I remember this distinctly, grinning like a lunatic. I mean, his entire head was just a grin, which was disconcerting. And he said, "Would you like to write a prisoner book with me?" Mm-hmm. Simple as that. I kind of probably looked at him quite drunkenly by that point because I was at a convention, and would have said, yeah, you know, assuming he was joking, and then, no, seriously, you know, explain about Matteo, you know, and I probably fell off my chair or something and went, well, yes, of course I will. I'd love to. Mm-hmm. And so it was simple as that. Basically, Kate and John had rated my writing, that they had been some of the first people to say to me, look, you know, you should look at doing this professionally because you're good enough. So it's all their fault. Thanks, Kate and John.
Thank you. Damn them. Look what they've done.
Damn their eyes. Damn them. Yeah. And so that then, obviously, the rest of it was done by email. I think we may have, I'm sure we discussed ideas that night or over the rest of the convention. Right. But the rest of it was very much all done by email.
Okay, so I'm always fascinated with time. The book was published in 2005. If I'm not mistaken, the convention, the LA science fiction convention you're talking about, happened in 2004, or was it 2002?
I can't remember. It could be two, three, or four. I'd say probably it probably was four. John would know. John's very good on dates.
Okay, got it. So now the idea of writing a book, great, that's a concept. But a concept requires blood, sweat, and tears to be able to go from big idea to chapter structure, concept, character development, words. How in the world did you collaborate? How did you do it? Did one of you take on big picture and one do detail? I'm fascinated to know how you made that come together.
You know what? Unfortunately, I'm going to let you down by saying I can't really remember. If I had John here, better at remembering. Maybe we should do an interview with him as well. Obviously, we had our lead character set. We had our scenario set.
Right.
It was the prisoner. We were talking about number six. Very early on, we both wanted to have a strong female character in. I'm afraid I honestly can't remember.
I understand. After
we would undoubtedly have sat down and come up with a plot line, Act one, act two, act three, broken it down. I remember distinctly we did end up breaking it down into, right, John will write this chunk, I'll write this chunk, and we'll then swap over and go through each other's bits and rewrite them and you know, that sort of thing. Because there was no way we could write together. We had to sit and, I think, we may have done a chapter each. It might have been you do chapter one, I'll do chapter, I think it was.
Okay, that even seems more intimidating to me, because if you were to take one and he the other, isn't the nature of writing to keep that thread tight in your hand as to what's happening? Because I've read your book now three times. I read it when I bought it. Quite frankly, I was very overwhelmed by the first time I read it, because you take the story into some very abstract areas. Then I read it again, and now for this audio program, it feels as though number 28 and I have gone back to school and we do book reports. And and reading it now to be able to, if you will, enunciate to others is where I find such interesting detail. Even insofar as early on, the book for the audience is devoted into four sections, and each section has a multiplicity of chapters. One of the things I found fascinating is your nod to McGowanism. You don't put a chapter 7 or 17 or 27 in the entire book. You did that on purpose, correct?
I can't remember. I'm so sorry.
It was always said that in the
I'm reading it today on Prisoner's Dilemma. It's a long time ago.
Understand, yeah. But that's the case. In the show, there was never an adjacent number to number six.
No.
And as I started to go through and diagram the book, I was like, oh, these bastards did the same thing. There's no seven or 17.
Well, we were both fans, so I mean, it is peppered with behind-the-scenes references, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Like a bit about someone points at number 48 and says, should we have him? And they go, no, he's weird.
No,
that he enjoyed.
And little, like, there's one statement early on, and I encourage anyone who is a fan of The Prisoner and or of good creative literature to grab this book, because it is not a fast read. It is a challenging, fun, and almost enthralling read, because you've got to be able to keep remembering where the reality of the story, if you will, goes, and the fantasy of what happens to the character. Mm-hmm. But you make this, or you or Jonathan make this statement about a gentleman riding through the village. And he twists and he turns and up a hill and down a hill. And it's as if the village never wants anyone to have a clear view straight ahead. And those are those little gems where I'm like, ah, I love this, because that's not only a clever writing instrument, but it's a brilliant observation as to both what happens in that tangible village and what happens in the show. There isn't a clear vista.
This is it. We were very, you know, one of that sounds like a bit of John's, actually. We were both very keen to try and make up for what we were losing by it not being a televisual episode.
Mm-hmm.
In things like that, details like that, or the, I remember one I put in was the stenographer cutting out paper men.
Oh, that was brilliant.
That sort of thing. Because The Prisoner's full of this. And, you know,
yes.
if you look at it from the kind of psychological torture side, yes, they're throwing you every single time. They're, as we say in England, taking the piss big time out of Netflix. You know, they're not just trying to break him. They're kind of pointing and laughing at him as they do so.
Oh, it's a cat playing with a mouse.
It is, absolutely, yeah. Which is beautiful when you get something like Hammer into Anvil, where he turns the tables on that. Where he starts learning the villager's game, you know. But in the earlier episodes, earlier in production run, which is my preferred viewing order, when he's out of his depth, and they're just throwing all this stuff at him, and the directors are throwing all this stuff at the audience as well. You know, you look at Arrival, it's all very disconcerting. It's all, you know, odd angles where you don't expect them, because that's John Chaffee being a brilliant director,
mm-hmm.
and wanting the audience to feel the unease that number six feels, the kind of like, this isn't right, this isn't real, this isn't Kansas anymore, Toto.
No. Did either or both of you gentlemen, together or alone, go to Port Merion? Because the detail by which you describe being literally at ground level is, at least to me, I had to believe you'd walk those hallways and those walkways, because you describe them with such truism that's just not because you saw the show. That's because I feel as if you walk those corridors.
I had certainly been there. I can't remember if John had been there by the time that we wrote that. I mean, he must have done. I'm not actually sure, you know, because it might be the first time he went there was for the launch. I went there the first time in 1991 after I'd finished watching it. But in 91, I was absolutely obsessed with The Prisoner.
Right.
And so it was inevitable that I eventually would get myself to Port Merion, and went to Port Merion and spent 2 days just walking. Walking. Doesn't he ever get tired? And did every single bit of it, reveling in the fact that, you know, it's perhaps the only place in the world where you can go and wander around a fictional place.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, I've had that thing of waking up after a party hungover and opening the curtains, and just for a second. I did that once, and it was at a convention, and you know, and then Rover bobbed by. It's kind of like, But I had definitely been to Port Merion several times by the time that we wrote the book.
That's awesome. Well, not to badger you then about these things I want you to recall from 15 years ago, but let's do this. When the book was finished, which is a mammoth task, and again, please take this praise for all I mean it to be, the fact that you started and stuck to it and completed a book of this volume, which is in the hundreds of pages, it's not only a gift to the community of Prisoner fans, but it's an accolade to the fact that you guys are diligent. You stayed with it.
I honestly must, and this isn't false modesty, give John the majority of the credit for, I mean, he wrote more of it than I did. John can produce enormous volumes of words. Mm-hmm. I produce about 4 words per day, and I usually delete them.
But it was still obviously a collaboration.
Well, this is the thing. I always enjoy co-writing, and one of the reasons is that when you run out of steam, your co-writer may not have done. And when they run out of steam, you're ready to take over again.
Yeah,
and you keep it going. You know, that melding of energies, not just creative energies in terms of thought process, but also simply getting the damn work done.
Exactly.
Now,
when the book was finished, here a child is born. This thing is born. You mentioned the idea of a launch party. Now, where I'm curious to go with is, you have given something to a community. Tell me about the good, the bad, the enthralling, or maybe the deflating of bringing something into a community of dog-minded fans. How did that feel to you? How did it work out? What was your level of both pride and satisfaction in giving that to the community of Prisoner fans?
I didn't see it in those terms. I didn't see it as being a gift to the Prisoner fan community. I saw it as being a novel that I'd been paid to co-write for a start. I was honored, absolutely honored, to be able to write The Prisoner, or our version of The Prisoner. So I was terrified when it went out. I was absolutely terrified. I am when anything I'm involved with goes out, whether I've invented, or created it or not, or if I'm just a part of it. I'm just sort of mortified with self-criticism and going, well, I could have done that an awful lot better every single time. But the initial response was very, very positive.
Right.
I seem to recall, possibly because there wasn't an awful lot of prisoner fiction around as well. There wasn't much to compare it to. There were the books from the 60s. But apart from that, I don't think there was really anything.
I'm glad to hear it.
The novel.
I'm so glad to hear it because, as people have heard me say before, and number 28 and I have gone on and on about this, just because something doesn't appeal to you doesn't mean you should deride it. Just because something doesn't speak to you as an art form doesn't mean you should discount it as bad. And a few weeks ago, we talked to David Leitch. David Leitch being one of the creative editors at Titan. And he was the person who conceptualized the 2018 four-part, he insisted I call them comic books, graphic novels called The Uncertainty Machine. And David tells the story that when the edition started to come out, he joined a couple of the Prisoner Facebook groups. Very prideful, very excited, and he said that after 2 weeks, he had to get out of them because there was just so many people saying such unbelievably negative things, not about only about the work, but about why would he, the pronoun, why would this person? And it's like, I can never understand that. If you don't like lemon meringue pie, why do you scream at the kitchen? Just get a piece of blueberry pie. You know?
Yeah, I know. I've never really understood why people spend so much time and effort posting I don't like this on the internet either. Don't get me wrong, if it's in the form of an actual discussion, I didn't think this was very good because, that's a different matter.
Agreed.
But if it's just, rant, rant, moan, moan, then who gives a shit?
Yeah.
But I don't recall any great amount of that. I didn't go looking much, probably out of fear.
Yeah.
But what I do remember, I remember doing an interview for Rick Davey for The Unmutual. And he was always very positive about this, bless his heart. He's another lovely guy. I don't remember anything hugely negative.
No, what about positive? You went and did an actual book launch at Port Merion, is that the case?
Yes.
That's awesome.
We launched it at a convention. For which I grew a small goatee for some inexplicable reason, and I look like Satan, so I never grow a goatee again. I just haven't got the shape face to do it. I look too much like an evildoer or a magician. And that was great. That was amazing. We did little readings of it over the tannoy system of Port Merion, where we'd all start by going ba 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 ba.
That is gorgeous. That is absolutely surreal.
We had a friend there, reading in one of the female parts. I think John read the text and I read in number six, which was always fun. And I recall we did a panel where we were talking about it. Matteo was there as well, I think. Yes, he was. Of course he was. So it was kind of the whole team, you know, all three of us really, who'd been behind it. And that was it was lovely to be spending time with them for a start, because with John being in Australia, Matteo being in America, and me being in England, I don't think the three of us have got together since.
So with the success, and I mean that sincerely, with the success of the Prisoners of the Limit happening, and I feel you had a positive experience from that, mm-hmm. then percolating in your mind might have been other things about the prisoner. Were you along that path to the next creation, were you open? Were you watching, reading, absorbing other things that are out there, such as the Big Finish audio productions or the 2010 remake? Did those filter into your world of the prisoner?
Well, the Big Finish, I haven't really heard any of at all. Obviously, that's comparatively recent. The remake, yeah, we can talk about the remake. I managed about 3/4 of an hour of the first episode of the remake and then gave up on two grounds. One, it wasn't The Prisoner, and two, it was the only remake I've ever seen that was slower paced than the original.
poor Jim. By
the time he's rolled down dunes about 100 times for 3 hours solid, I was just thinking, well, hang on, we were into Free For All by this point in the original series, you know, practically at Fallout. I think it rather missed the point of The Prisoner, because the point of The Prisoner, if you're doing it like that, is McGoohan.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. People have heard me say, I argue that I think for me, the reason why I appreciate it is the through line of what I've been saying all along. Mm-hmm. There was an immense amount of creative capital mm-hmm. and sweat that went into that performance. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they did it in Namibia, that they didn't mm-hmm. just do it in East Los Angeles, the fact that you had actors who were really striving to create their own characterizations. And I think, I'm sure they all knew they would be under the threat of people saying, it's not the same.
Well, that's best summed up for me by a friend of mine, very intelligent friend, who did watch the entire series. And I said mm-hmm. at the end, so, you know, what's your verdict? And he said, it was a good little science fiction series. It wasn't The Prisoner.
I agree. And I think it probably would have had a better reception if people would have, like they did with Battlestar Galactica, if it would have been very upfront to say, this is a re-imaging, as opposed to saying, this is The Prisoner. If they would have taken control of the, and I hate this terminology, but taken control of the narrative and said, in homage, in honor, in retrospect, this is another version. But when you just say, this is Cleopatra and this is Cleopatra, they're not the same thing.
Indeed, yes, just so.
Right.
Just so.
Right. So I think they hurt themselves a little bit by not distinguishing their own creative production.
I think what would have been lovely with that, just to sort of spitball ideas for a moment, is if mm-hmm. the first season had gone through and it wasn't until towards the end of the first season that he started realizing there was a history about this place and there was more than he knew. And there used to be this guy called Number Six, and it used to be set in a different village, and so on and so on and so on. And you could bring people on board that way, you know. That might be a better way of doing it. But, I don't know.
My two cents, and I think this would have compelled more Prisoner fans to have enjoyed the reimagining, is one very essential factor. Mm-hmm. It's a factor that I believe makes the original show as powerful as it is. It's the constantly changing Number Two characters. It is the fact that Number Six, and I've equated this to my own life and others' lives, you have a job. You go to a job every day, and one day your boss comes in and says, hey, I'm quitting. And you're getting somebody new. And you have no emotional collateral, no knowledge of this other person. And you have to be the bearer of the burden of recreating that relationship.
You go right back to square one every time, yes.
Every time. But in the AMC ITV one, the challenge was, because you had an actor of the amazing character, that is that person who played number two.
Absolutely.
I can't imagine he would have said, I'll come in and do an episode and a half. You wouldn't have. So for the fans, what happened is we felt it was discongruous to the nature of this incongruous idea of you should never build a rapport between number two and number six.
That. I agree. I agree entirely. I've always said that if you know, someone gave me the reins and said, right, you're now in charge of making a series of The Prisoner for ITV or whatever, I'd throw everything away apart from Port Merrion Rover and the numbers. I think you've got to have Port Merrion. I think it's the village is so much the other main character in it. Because as you say, number two does change. So the village is in its own face, if you like.
Yeah. It's the construct of the context. Yeah. It's the fact that it is so beautiful that you are psychologically confused to say, but in this gorgeous, beautiful daylit scene, how can I feel oppressed? And what they tried to do in the miniseries by putting it again in a very sunlit environment was to get an idea of that. But here's the difference. Water is an illustration of opportunity. Water says, I can go away. Mm-hmm. If you look in any place and you look out on a bay, an ocean, you think to yourself, you know what? If I swam or paddled far enough, I could get the hell away from this.
The horizon, yeah.
But in a desert, you don't feel the same way. The desert, it closes in on you. So that's also a, if you will, that's a structural choice they made that I think felt different. Because how long could you run in the desert before we know you're going to die of thirst?
This is it. It's a much less subtle prison.
Mm-hmm.
And the prisoner is subtle. The prisoner is devious.
Very subtle.
And it plays with you as the village plays with number six. Whereas that setup instantly was vastly less interesting.
Yeah, cut off. It was very cut off.
Yeah.
Well, now, in that way, of our discussion of those diligences and auteurs and art and commitment, you decided to manifest that same thing again in both exploration and homage to Patrick McGoohan.
Yes.
And some crazy distance of only 5 years later, you decided to start putting pen to paper or fingers on a keyboard, and you created, and this time I'm gonna hold fast to say you gave the community this book, because it wouldn't exist without you. You created this glorious, not only biography, but historiography of The Prisoner and Patrick McGoohan in your edition, Not a Number.
Very kind.
That you did by yourself. There was no collaboration, right? You sat and wrote and studied and composed this just yourself. True?
Absolutely, but with an awful lot of interviewees helping out. I mean, you know, a lot of people.
Absolutely. But there was no Jonathan, that riffraff. He was over in Australia.
No, I mean, no, I wasn't. I didn't co-write it with anyone. No.
Got it. How long from the point when you had the glimmering idea, the glare of an idea, I want to compose a story about a person I appreciate, how long was the timeline in general from idea to holding a copy in your hand?
I suppose that I couldn't tell you when the idea was. The catalyst was there was a book fair. And I was asked to provide a couple of pitch ideas for that, for factual stuff particularly. And one of the things that came to my mind was the biography of McGoohan, because I'd kind of been researching it for the last 20 years out of my own interest in him since the age of 18 when I'd seen The Prisoner.
Right.
To start off with, you know, by being a member of Six of One and reading about him and all the interviews and all that sort of thing. And then when YouTube comes along, gloriously, lots of interviews start going up online. I collected everything I could. I was as fascinated by the man as I was by his creation. Mm-hmm. I found it too indivisible. I still do. Mm-hmm. Which is a good thing, by the way, I think. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can't really say when the idea of doing it, I suppose that pitch meeting is when it crystallized into the idea of doing it. It went very speedily from then on. It took me 3 months solid to write.
Really? That's all?
Well, I know everyone's always surprised by that, but like I say, that's with 20 years head start.
Okay, because here's another praise that I absolutely need and must heap upon you.
You don't have to, honestly.
Here's why I have to, because it's something I think our world is very quickly losing. you wrote a book that is substantiated and annotated. And as someone who works in I work in an engineering field with people who sometimes when I would give them documents, they would have footnotes. They would look at it and go, well, we don't need these. And I will say to this day, yes, you do, because you write for a legacy. You write for planning. And your book, Rupert, not only has these glorious and gorgeous full quotations from sources that you found, whether they be books, whether they be interviews you conducted or extracts from videos, but you compose an actual annotation of saying to we as readers, I wasn't just stoned and thought this up. Here's where it came from. And in today's world, I find that we're losing that. I find that we have people who make prognostications and they make statements, but there's never any way for us to say, and how do you substantiate that?
The internet is not as good for that as a published book, really, is it?
No. Well, I have books, Rupert, I have books that don't have a single testament to where they came up with the idea other than their own statements. Your book is...
The thing is, I felt hugely responsible for it. I thought, well, if I'm going to put my head above the parapet and go, all right, here's my opinion of who Patrick McGoohan was. And that's all it can be. I did not meet him. I did not know him.
Right.
All I could do was, you know, like everyone else has tried to, put together the pieces, make a coherent narrative. What I wanted to do was obviously give the narrative story of his life.
Mm-hmm.
But I was very keen to try and analyze to an extent and you know, find out what was inside that skull, what did motivate him to make the prisoner particularly, or in general.
Yep.
And of course, you know, and you absolutely want to make sure that that's cast iron and annotated and down. I suppose I approached it as a kind of academic text in that way.
Yeah.
Because I thought, well, we've got to. You know, I'm not, because as well, because of the passion there is about McGoohan from, you know, a relatively comparatively small number of people to things like Star Trek, as you were saying earlier. Nevertheless, very intelligent people, very, you know, who question, who listened to what McGoohan said and question.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, I'm going to do my very best to at least get my facts right.
And I love that you also paint him in both sides of a human character. You... When getting into the chapters about the production of the show, I would go as a reader from a sense of empathy to the pressure the man was under and saying, I get it. This is crazy. But then you also were egalitarian enough to point out that he could be a true asshole sometimes. And that is the nature of someone who is hyper creative. You do not get great art from bland people. You don't.
Absolutely not.
And so there were times when I would read extracts and I'd go, God, I don't like this man. but I also had to understand that this was a man, to use the analogy of the Hercules structure in Port Merion, who wasn't lifting this production. The production was pressing him down.
Very well put, yeah.
And so though we're all imperfectly perfect, you tell both the occasions and the anecdotes where he was gloriously supportive to people, gloriously kind. But again, he was also a frailed and flawed person, and sometimes he probably needed a good slap in the face. But
as do we all.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You know.
Right.
I was, when I started out, I thought to myself, right, I am not going to write a hagiography. I adore McGoohan. I have enormous respect for McGoohan. McGoohan and the prisoner helped shape me. But I thought to myself, the catalyst, I'll tell you what the catalyst for it was. I've remembered it was when I heard he died.
Really? So 2009.
It was on Newsnight, BBC Newsnight. And it was the last story, and it was just kind of like, and Patrick McGoohan has died, and they played the prisoner theme. And I thought, is that it? And nothing else. It wasn't the big thing in the newspapers and stuff. And I thought, no, seriously? That's not right. And that's when I started thinking, well, if no one else is going to fucking stand up and say something, then I'm going to have to, arrogantly.
Bravely.
When I decided I was, you know, when I got the commission to write this, I kind of looked up to the sky a bit and went, all right, Patrick, I'm going to tell what I perceive to be the truth about you. And if you don't like it, well, there you are. That's the only thing. It's the only thing he would respect.
Yes. And I would, in a metaphysical sense, I would agree that if Patrick was reading this book somewhere, sometime, he would say, this young man understood me. Because you do see, warts and all, someone who was definitive, diligent, and dogmatic, but also, again, could be perfectly imperfect, like some of us are. So,
I mean, I can't claim to have understood him. I did my best. I made my best stab. I mean, you know, annoyingly, having met people since the book, because of it, I have, I think, a greater understanding of him.
Right.
So look out for the second edition.
Okay, good. Because for me, again, as a fan of the program, the man, the concepts behind it, having your book in my archive is something that really I feel honored to have.
Oh, good. Well, thank you. I feel very honored that you feel honored. I mean, you know.
All villagers are encouraged to share their thoughts and contributions with the Eternal Village cast. Please visit theeternalvillage.org, where you'll find our email address, links to our social media accounts, and online forms to capture your information.